You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
For those not familiar with the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, we are a private nonprofit organization devoted to fundraising, advocacy, and innovative programming in support of the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you to all the Library Foundation supporters and members who are with us this evening. If you are not a member or supporter yet, I hope you will consider joining the Library Foundation. And right here, you see this QR code, because I hope you will consider joining to continue to see programs like this one and to increase critical access to information, resources, and technology to help all Angelenos around this city fulfill their dreams. I'd like to also thank our sponsors, Aaron F. Fox Schiff, the Estate of E. Aaron, Golden Globe Foundation, Hearst Foundation, the Judith and Steve Krantz Foundation, Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Sharon Oxborough, Ralph M. Parsons, and Gregory Peck Literary Foundation, and of course, all those individual donors and members in the audience. Thank you. Aloud is expanding its footprint and scope. We are adding our already popular author series with three additional branches, so to speak. Aloud and Community, a series we will co-produce with chosen branches each season by helping to facilitate and support several programs. Aloud and Review, which will focus on a book or theme, but will approach it in an unconventional format, meaning more cabaret than conversation. Aloud on Ideas, a thematic series that looks deeply at subjects in the zeitgeist. We'll be focusing with a three-part series on AI, the first of which begins Thursday, March 28th, with an amazing group of experts of all ages discussing AI's impact on our youth. The discussion will be both, I think, surprising and informative to all, so I encourage you to come. And finally, one more note, we have more Tolls tickets. They're still available on our website, and we just released some really great seats that we had held back. So for more information on all Aloud programs, visit lfla.org. And now for tonight's program, I'm honored to introduce two wonderful writers, Leslie Jamison and Sarah Mancuso, both of whom write with a deep sensitivity, and are able to crystallize a description, a detail with such precision that it's etched into the reader's brain. This evening, they will discuss Leslie Jamison's newly released memoir, Splinters, about the end of her marriage, the birth of her daughter, single parenthood, her writing, her own parents' complicated marriage, her ambivalence. The list is long when covering a traumatic transition in life. Jamison writes with empathy and emotional clarity, tinged with sadness and pain, and yes, at times humor, but she's always in control. Her razor-sharp observations are reminiscent of Joan Didion, but Jamison is able to be both an observer and a participant, emotionally invested, not detached like Didion. In Splinters, Leslie Jamison delves into the pains and joys of what it is to fall in and out of romantic love and fall back again into a new love, a paternal love, even if ambivalently, but with complete abandon. Quote, loving her wasn't a pure feeling, it was an everything feeling. It shuttled back and forth between wanting to merge with her completely and wanting to flee. Was my love for her contaminated by checking email every 2 minutes on the phone? Did this polluted attention count? And who was doing the counting anyway? My notion of divinity was gradually turning its gaze away from the appraising, tallying, keeping pseudo-father in the sky who would give me gold stars if I did enough good things, and toward the mother who'd been here all along. With less patience for my performances and more patience for everything else. I was living toward joy that was less about earning and more about ambush, a joy you might call grace. Leslie Jamison is the author of the New York Times bestsellers, The Recovering and The Empathy Exams. The collection of essays, Make It Scream, Make It Burn. and the novel The Gin Closet, a finalist for the Penn Diamondstein Spiegel-Vogel Award, and a finalist for Los Angeles Times Book Prize. She writes for numerous publications, including The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New York Times, Harper's, and The New York Review of Books. Not one book. Sarah Manguzzo is the author of 9 books, most recently the novel Very Cold People, which was longlisted for the Penn Jean Stein Book Award, as well as a story collection, 2 poetry collections, 4 acclaimed works of nonfiction, 300 Arguments, Ongoingness, The Guardians, and 2 Kinds of Decay, which was shortlisted for the Wellcome Book Prize. Her novel Liars is forthcoming in July 2024. Her work has been recognized by the American Academy of Arts and Letters, Literature Award, a Guggenheim Fellowship, a Hodder Prize, and the Rome Prize. Please welcome Leslie Jamieson and Sarah Manguzzo. Thank you.
Hi, how are y'all doing? Welcome, thanks for coming out. Thank you, Sarah, for doing this
total
event.
Pleasure.
Yeah, it's really
continuation of the last time we did this 9 years ago. So we're just gonna pick up exactly where we left off,
yes. Yeah. Sarah, well, I feel in a way like we've been in conversation for even longer than that because I've been reading and loving your work, and then we've just been in dialogue about different projects. We've both been, our most recent book, Sarah has a wonderful novel called Liars coming out this summer that is, we were able to swap Splinters and Liars a few months ago and realized that kind of furtively, without our knowing it, our books had been having a conversation without us, and that we're sort of catching up to you know, what our books were already saying in a way, so... It's a pleasure, such a pleasure to be here. Even though I'm from the West Side, I do consider this a hometown reading. I thank you to those of you who came from the West Side, Sarah included. It's a truly momentous act, so I appreciate it. And it means a lot
to me.
You're
welcome.
Yeah. Yeah, it just means a lot to me always to come back to LA and to share work here and to see familiar faces from many, many different life eras and some new faces too. So I think I'm going to read a little bit from the beginning of this book and then we'll talk and then we'll have some time for questions from, I was going to say all of you, maybe not every single one of you, but some of you. And I don't think you need to know too much. I'm going to read from the beginning, except I'll say that this book is divided into 3 sections. They're called Milk, Smoke, and Fever. And each of them begins with a kind of a prose poem. I think of these poems as Google lyrics. They are composed of Google searches. I got really interested in Google as a kind of confessional booth, like a place where we take questions, sources of shame and anxiety, like unanswerable points of fixation. And sometimes it's just easier to bring them to Google than to another human being. And so there's a kind of a privacy and a almost like an encounter with not quite the divine, but something unknown and powerful that might deliver up an answer. So I started to think what, craft-wise, like what might a kind of compendium of one's Google searches say about a certain era in your life? And that's where these emerged from. So I'm going to start by reading the Google lyric that shows up at the very beginning of the book, at the start of the section called Milk. What is the robot owl that makes babies fall asleep? What is the doll with a heartbeat that makes babies fall asleep? What is the name of the $1,000 crib that does everything a mother does? Does the skin shelf above a C-section scar ever go away? Marina Abramovich had how many abortions? Why is the cold moon also called the morning moon? Is a flying ant always the queen trying to start a new colony? What makes the queen ant want to start a new colony? What is the average hourly rate for divorce lawyers in New York City? How will the wolf moon change my life? The baby and I arrived at our sublet with garbage bags full of shampoo and teething crackers, sleeves of instant oatmeal, zippered pajamas with little dangling feet. At a certain point, I'd run out of suitcases. We had diapers patterned with drawings of scrambled eggs and bacon. Why put breakfast on diapers, I might have asked, if there had been another adult in the room. There was not. Outside, it was 19 degrees in the sun. For the next month, we were renting this railroad one-bedroom beside a firehouse. I'd brought raspberries and a travel crib, white Christmas lights to make the dim space glow. Next door, a fireman strutted toward his engine with a chainsaw in one hand and a box of Cheerios in the other. My baby tracked his every move. What was he doing with her cereal? This is a really nice little LA crowd. It's a nice laughter in here. I like it. I'm feeling a hometown welcome. It was only, and you're also allowed to laugh during parts that get a little dark. Sometimes I think people need permission too. That once like divorce comes up, they're like, I don't laugh anymore. You can still laugh. It was only when I told my divorce lawyer she is 13 months old that my voice finally broke. As it turns out, divorce lawyers keep tissues in their offices just like therapists, only not as ready to hand. I know we've got them somewhere, she told me warily, rising from her swivel chair to search. As if to say, we aren't surprised by your tears, but it's not our job to manage them. If I cried for 5 minutes, it would cost me $50. Just over 13 months, I said, wanting to make it seem like we'd stayed married longer than we actually had. Again and again, he told me, our baby is just 1 year old. My best friend said, better to get out now. It did not help to argue with him in my head. It only helped to hold the baby so close that the globe of her belly became the whole world. And even that, well, it cut both ways. Our sublet was long and dark. A friend called it our birth canal. It seemed to be owned by artists. It was not made for a child. The coffee table was just a stylish slab of wood resting on cinder blocks. The biggest piece of art was a large white canvas that looked like a wall hanging on the wall. Sometimes the firemen next door ran their chainsaws for no good reason. But what did I know? Maybe there was a reason for everything. After my reading in Washington, D.C. a couple weeks ago, there was a man in the signing line. And when he got to the front, he introduced himself as a fireman. And he said, you know, I can tell you why the firemen were running their chainsaws. And I thought, wow, like, sometimes you think the universe does have an answer waiting for you, and then it delivers it when the time is right. So we can talk about that later if you want. Yeah. Our nights were full of instant ramen and clementines. My fingers smelled like oranges all winter. Our rooms were lit by the liquid pulsing of red siren lights through the slatted blinds. The kitchen counters were streaked with trails of red velvet batter and little beige buttons of hardened pancake mix, the residue of throwing sugar at a problem. By day, my baby crouched among the heavy art books with her wooden maraca and smacked the translucent pages of a story about a pile of leaves. The willow, the birch, the stray mitten, the lost key, and at the very bottom, a tiny worm. My baby was gentle with her stuffed moose, nuzzling his patchy brown fur against her cheek. But with her wooden xylophone, she was an Old Testament god. It barely survived her music. We moved out in the middle of flu season. One night, I woke up at 4 in the morning with my mouth full of sweet saliva. I stumbled to the bathroom past the dreaming baby and knelt in front of the toilet until dawn. When the baby woke, I crawled after her from room to room, then lay on my side on the wooden floor and watched her sideways. I didn't have the strength to stand, but I didn't want her out of my sight. The things she put in her mouth just blew my mind. All I could do was lie beside her toys, wrapped in a gray blanket, flushed and shivering. She handed me her favorite wooden stick, the one she used to play her rainbow xylophone. She picked up a Cheerio from the floor and lifted it tenderly toward my mouth. I was myself a child of divorce, as they say, as if divorce were a parent. When I was very young, I thought divorce involved a ceremony. The couple moved backward through the choreography of their wedding, starting at the altar, unclasping their hands, and then walking separately down the aisle. I once asked a friend of my parents, "Did you have a nice divorce?" Falling in love with C was not gradual. Falling in love with C was encompassing, consuming, life-expanding. It was like ripping hunks from a loaf of fresh bread and stuffing them in my mouth. In those early days, he was a man frying little discs of sausage on a hot plate in a Paris garret, asking me to marry him, making me laugh so hard I slipped off our red couch. Loving the smoked tacos we got from a tiny shack just north of Morro Bay, pointing out backyard chickens from the garage we rented behind a surfer's bachelor pad, putting his hand on my thigh while I drank contrast fluid that tasted like bitter Gatorade before a CT scan to find my burst ovarian cyst. Playing the nitty-gritty dirt band on a road trip, putting a cinnamon bear on our rental car dashboard because it was our mascot, our trusty guide, our thing. We had 1,000 things, like everyone, but ours were only ours. Who will find them beautiful now? In those early days, he was a man ordering room service steak at the Golden Nugget after we said our vows in a Vegas wedding chapel at midnight. He was a man curled beside me watching our favorite obstacle course program on TV, a man getting my face tattooed on his biceps, a man whispering in my ear at a crowded party. He is still that man. I am still that woman. We have betrayed those tender people, but we still carry them around inside of us wherever we go. Thanks.
But first, the firemen.
So the story, the firemen explained to me that firemen are always running their chainsaws, or I guess to be more specific, running their chainsaws at all sorts of improbable times, because you never know when you might need to use your chainsaw in an urgent situation. So you always have to make sure that your chainsaw is operational. So it's a kind of a like keeping the, you know, checking the fire door to make sure it still opens, like making sure the chainsaw is just running. I think they can fall off their, like, we've reached the end of my technical language before it even began, but like the way that the little like teeth, mm-hmm. Can we go with that? Yeah, okay. The way the little teeth, I think it's easy for them to sort of like fall off their little architecture. I'm sure it's not called the architecture of the chainsaw, but I think it's easily displaced, so you always have to make sure that it's operational.
Okay.
You guys never knew. You never imagined how much you were going to learn about fire arts.
The last thing I'm going to say about firemen, but I know that there's a difference, a personality difference between hook and ladder. So you always want to ask.
Amazing. Great question. If I ever meet a fireman again,
hook or ladder. Yeah, next time you're in Staten Island. Leslie, you're celebrated for all of the writing that you do. But if I had to say... If I had to answer the question, what's up with Leslie Jameson, I would say, well, she's celebrated for a kind of critical writing that is always narrative, always lyric, always somehow autobiographical, but not in a narcissistic way, which for me, a repeat autobiographer, is an extraordinarily admirable effect. But this is your first, capital M memoir, and I really wanted to ask you about, I want to hear about the publication decision, but I really want first to ask you how this book feels in the context of your other books. Like, is it a direct continuation? Is it a departure? Is it both? Is it neither?
Yeah, I love that way of thinking about the question of, I guess genre. Yeah, I've written in a lot of different genres and maybe a lot of different kind of versions of what nonfiction can look like. So, my first book was a novel, and since then I've written two collections of essays that sort of have sculpted a kind of hybrid form. They bring together, as you're saying, criticism and personal narrative, and often literary reportage and cultural history. And this book, Splinters, from very early on, it announced itself to me as a different size and shape and texture of book than anything I'd written before. I mean, I think some of its preoccupations are absolutely connected to my previous work. This is a book that is deeply invested in kind of thresholds of transformation. Like, the two thresholds of transformation at the center of this book are becoming a parent and ending a marriage. And those are not forms of transformation that I had really written about before, but always I think I've been writing about different kinds of thresholds of transformation, whether it's like pain as a threshold of transformation, encountering other people's pain as a threshold of transformation, sobriety as a threshold of transformation. And this kind of, I think part of what's interesting to me about transformation is like, what parts of yourself do you carry with you, and what parts of yourself do you leave behind, and what parts of yourself do you sort of find in there that have been with you all along, but you never fully knew them, or you could never fully see them? Like, all of these questions about the kind of like self in revision are really interesting to me. And so in that sense, I think this book is absolutely continuing some of my earlier preoccupations, although maybe it feels less like conscious continuation and more like my obsessions keep finding me no matter what I think I'm writing about. I'm also really interested in intimacy, what intimacy feels like, what love feels like, what kind of attention, paying attention to the world feels like. And all of those are in here, but they don't feel like they were born here, like they feel like they were born, I don't know, 40 years ago or like in the first things I ever wrote. But what felt new about this book was the texture of it and its rhythm. So even before I kind of knew that it was going to be pretty wholly personal narrative in a way that I had never done before, I kind of found the form of it. And the form of it was crucial to my understanding how I was even going to go about writing personal narrative. And the form, the title, Splinters, is very much, it's an emotional evocation. Like this book and this story is really interested in like what are memories, moments, experiences, relationships that often painfully get inside of you and stay there, even when, you know, even when they're not part of your life anymore, they sort of still live inside of you under the skin. What does that feel like? What does it feel like to be kind of transformed by that pain and to have yourself sort of reshaped by it? So Splinters in that sense is talking about painful things that get under the skin, but it's also really talking about the units of prose that this book is built of, these sort of sharp, whittled fragments. They're like anywhere from a paragraph to a page. A poet who I did an event with last week, Roger Reeves, said they go up to 5 paragraphs long. I hadn't counted, but I love that he did. And I trust him. I didn't double check him, but I trust him. But they're short. They're kind of these distillations. And they create a certain rhythm in the book that's it has a certain momentum, and it allowed me to pivot quite a bit between different parts of my life, different times in my life. And once I found that form, I decided that the way I wanted to write the book was to stay close to a particular experience, my own, rather than kind of moving between experiences in the way that my work often does. I wanted to go as deep as possible and be as intimate as possible with a particular life and find the kind of truth that gets yielded in that focused gaze.
This maybe isn't a fair follow-up question, because who are we to say where our ideas come from? But why do you think that happened?
I think some of it was very, I think some of it was just listening to my own intuitions about the language, that it felt, I always believe, and I'm curious how this feels for you, I believe very deeply in listening to the prose that I'm writing and following that prose to the places where it feels like it has the most heat, the most urgency, the most intensity. And as I started to work on this project, that heat and that intensity felt like it existed when I was staying close to my life. And there were times when I would, you know, experiment with maybe a kind of writing that was more similar to writing I've done in the past, where I would say, well, what if I did a kind of cultural deep dive into the history of divorce laws in America? What if I had a section on women in the 1920s who stayed in these hotels in Reno when Nevada was the only place where you could get a divorce? And what was life like in those hotels? Like, it's all totally fascinating, but what I felt when I started to write away from my experience and into those histories was a sense of dilution and diminishment. I felt that this pulse that was really moving for me quite strongly in the writing of these pages, I started to lose it. It felt fainter, and all I knew was that I had to follow the pulse where it felt strongest.
Yeah, I love the way that you put that. I say it in a sort of more vulgar way, which is that as soon as it starts feeling like homework, I stop. But yeah, no, absolutely. It's an intuition. It's wonderful to hear. I want to ask you about motherhood. But first I want to ask you about marriage. And I'm actually going to read you to you. There's a moment in the book that felt as if it were placing a finger on the pulse of something that is happening in literature and in just, you know, what's happening socially in conversations among women right now. So this is an aside, you to yourself, read by myself. And I quote, I wish there were a way to say, your work matters, addressing the husband. that didn't involve muting my own. I did say it, but not enough, or so much that it started to sound rote. I'm not sure what the question is other than that. It feels as if this narrative is kind of taking root. It definitely took me almost two decades to admit that that had been going on in my marriage. But I wonder what your thoughts are on this. And you have, I'm sure, read Isabel's essay in The Guardian about, thank you, Kaplan. She wrote a viral essay in The Guardian about a boyfriend who used to complain that she wasn't successful a writer enough to be his girlfriend, and then when she became too successful, he had to break up with her because she was too successful. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there are 1,000 different ways that I would answer this question, and some of them are the ways I would answer it, you know, just there in the backstage room. But I think one of the things that I was thinking about when I was trying to figure out how to tell the particular strand in this book that is the story of the marriage. And it's only one strand in the book, I think, because we have a sort of, in this cultural moment, there's a bit of a fascination. I mean, there's both a preponderance of kind of wonderful stories of divorce, not necessarily stories of wonderful divorce, but wonderful stories of divorce that look at that experience of rupture in really illuminating and clear-eyed ways. And also because I think it's just a question people are interested in asking. I think there, you know, this gets called often a divorce memoir, and in lots of ways it is, but that's kind of one of many stories here. It's also really at the heart. It's a story of motherhood. That's the love story that I think of as most at its core, even if it's, the book is subtitled Another Kind of Love Story, and it's made of many love stories. But I think... the story of being a teacher, the story of being a friend, the story of rebuilding a life after the end of the life I thought I was living, like all of these are the kind of engines of the book. But I think the part of this book that was absolutely hardest for me to write was the story of the marriage. And I think part of what was difficult about it was trying to figure out how to both evoke, not only how to evoke to the extent that I was going to evoke it, why things fell apart and how they fell apart, but really to try to dig underneath that falling apart to find and express what had been beautiful and what the love had looked like. And I remember Mary Carr, who has written about divorce in really illuminating ways herself, gave me a great piece of advice when she read an early draft of the book. She said, look, to write the sorrow of divorce, you don't write what was hard about the divorce. You write what was beautiful about the love that came before. Like that's what gives the grief its edge. Like that's what gives it its blade. And so I think I tried to really follow that back into a narration of the marriage that would kind of honor not just for some existential abstract outside feeling like I needed to honor some part of reality simply because it had been, but really for the purposes of the narrative, wanting to write that love so that a reader could go on that journey with me and feel the kind of heartbreak of it not being what we both imagined and hoped it could be. And within that, to the line that you pointed to, I wanted to both write a bit of what had been difficult about trying to hold two careers and two sets of ambitions and two sets of creative desires, and the creative world can be like a brutal world in lots of ways. Like you work really hard and the world shrugs at what you've done, you know, and it can be a brutal feeling. I wanted to write the ways that all of those were kind of pressurizing forces, but in a way it's like, if the first impulse is to write, okay, these were the pressurizing forces, I also then needed to write even further back into the ways that it had been a truly beautiful part of the marriage in these pages that we had
read and loved each other's work, that we were readers for each other, that we gave each other, we were first readers for each other. We gave each other our manuscripts very early on and treated them with great reverence and tenderness and rigor. And so I wanted to write that too. I wanted to write that kind of part of the difficulty of this kind of professional static, this often kind of brutal professional static, was that this was also a union between two artists who deeply respected each other's work.
Let's talk about love. I really loved, your subtitle, which is, of course, Another Kind of Love. Is it? Another Kind of Love Story. Which just beautifully sets up one of my favorite qualities of the book, which is that it really scrambles heteronormativity in a way that I think, feels very pressing for me as a heterosexual person. Like, how to be heterosexual without being heteronormative? And really my favorite part of the book is all of the ways that you depict deep, genuine love, particularly the sort of the tripartite love between you, your mother, and your daughter, this simultaneous mothering and daughtering that takes place in, I guess in all three sections, but primarily the first section. And I think that's what really distinguishes this book from the large and growing pile of motherhood-themed books that seems to have really just like happened in the last 10 or 15 years. And I'm guilty of adding to that pile. I also love the way you talk about your female friendships as, you know, possessing a kind of unique and genuine depth that's different from, perhaps better than, the sort of romantic loves that are pursued in the book among the various lovers. And, I think you say at least at one point that the female friendships that have accompanied you through all of these romantic relationships have been almost like better and deeper and more reliable company than these romantic relationships, which are, of course, you know, the plot. They're the whirlwind. And I think you're onto something with that observation, but I was wondering if you could talk about that as the sort of balancing factor to the more traditional loves.
Yeah, I love talking about friendship, and I love talking about friendship in this book, and it feels great to talk about friendship in LA, which is where my oldest and deepest friendships date back to when I was a girl, and still friendships that are part of my life. So this feels like the city in which I was schooled in what friendship could be. I think part of the story that I wanted to tell here about building a life, basically, like, it felt like a wrecking ball destroyed my home, but I was the wrecking ball. You know what I mean? It felt like my home and the life I thought I was living had fallen apart. And in the aftermath of that rupture, like, what was the new life I was going to build? And what forms of love and caregiving and community and bond, like, constituted that new life that I was building? And so I think there's a kind of natural way in which at first loneliness inside the marriage and then solitude in the aftermath of the marriage, or a sort of a home alone after the marriage, both of these sort of sharpened my gaze. I was hungry for, like, what are the other kinds of bonds that one can build a life from? And so in a way it was like, even if friendship had been, as it truly had been, a constitutive defining force in my life always, it was like I came to it with a kind of sharpened hunger once I felt part betrayed by, part I had failed the kind of the sort of family that you're supposed to build and the sort of way that your adult life is supposed to look. And once my adult life didn't look that way anymore, I was like, okay, where are the other places love lives? And I saw, of course, where it had always been living, which was like in friendship all around me. And so that's part of how the exploration of friendship as a form of love is connected to the narrative engine of a marriage falling apart here. And I was very interested in kind of trying to, it was actually a great piece of it. I was very interested in digging into, like, what is the nature of the love that lives in my friendships, and what kind of self, what sort of self do I feel able to become inside my friendships, able to be? And I got this great piece of editorial guidance from my editor, Ben, who I've worked with for like a decade now. And in it, the first draft of the book, friends came up a lot, like in scenes. Like there would be memories of going to the Turkish baths underneath the tenements, and underneath this particular tenement on East 10th Street in the East Village. Or there would be moments of like going to a drag show in Astoria with my friend Heather, or my friend Colleen coming to help me take care of my baby after she was born. But my editor said, you know, we see these friends coming in and out, but it's hard for a reader to know why they're that important. He was sort of putting it gently, but he was basically like, it doesn't really seem like these, for the, he's like, I understand these friends matter to you, but they don't yet matter to the narrative. And he kind of pushed me to write some splinters, some short sections, where I was really doing a little bit more telling alongside the showing, I guess. You know, we talk a lot in writing workshops about showing as a sort of superior form of dramatizing to telling. I love telling. I love to tell things. I think telling, you know, I understand why people say show, don't tell. I think it's easier to fail at telling than showing. But I think there's a lot of work that telling can do, and a lot of really exciting work it can do. And I felt grateful for this kind of gauntlet, almost inadvertently thrown down by my editor, which was like, take this form of nourishment that has sustained you for your entire life, i.e. friendship, and try to give some language to what that nourishment has offered you, and or what that nourishment has been. And I ended up really coming to a couple of ideas. One was this thing that I think friends have often shared with my mother, which is this feeling that there is a love that I'm giving you that you don't have to keep earning. Like, it's here. Like, I am here. A kind of presence that doesn't feel contingent in every moment. And I think there's also a way that friendships have felt like spaces, bonds that could hold all of me, in which I didn't need to contort myself in any particular way. I didn't need to constantly curate, modulate, titrate, figure out what I could say and what I couldn't say, or what would be triggering, or, you know, I didn't have to perform myself as like this super interesting version of myself. You know, friendships were the spaces where I could be a version of myself that felt, I don't want to say unperformed, because I think we're sort of always doing some kind of performing, but friendships often felt like I could be a version of myself that felt closest to uncontorted in some way. And it was helpful. It was helpful to be provoked to try to find more precise and specific language for the nature and texture of this friend love that I had, that had been the oxygen that I had been breathing the whole time.
You just answered my next 8 questions, I think, but it's fine. I'm a professional. I'm so glad that you characterized that love as nourishment, and that a moment ago you were talking about hunger, the hunger that led you to search for some alternative to what no longer existed. And I wanted to kind of shift gears here and talk about where the creative, you know, impulse comes from. And as your, you know, devoted reader through, I haven't read your early novel, but I've read all of your other books, you know, we're both addicts in recovery, and we're very different writers. And what, you know I can always sink my teeth into with your writing is that there's just panoplies and piles and richness, and it's just a smorgasbord every single time. And I, you know, I'm a different kind of writer, but I'm fascinated by the, I don't want to call it, you know, childlike or youthful, but it's just this this vivacious hunger, this like wide-ranging readiness to perceive and process everything. And I'm wondering if, I mean, is it's this might sound facile, but it just seems like a beautiful redirection of the addict's hunger. And I wonder if, does it ever feel like I'm doing the healthy thing, or does it feel like, oh, okay, this is my pathological behavior. I've reformatted somehow.
No, I love the invitation to think about all of these strands together that you've offered, because I do think, you know, as you were speaking, I kept thinking about this sober addict who I quote at one point in the book. I think of so many of the best lines in this book as belonging to other characters. I think that's like a hallmark of personal narrative that I like, is often when like a lot of the best lines aren't the narrator's. And I think here, I honestly think a lot of the best lines in this book are my daughter's, even though it's like she's two by the time it ends. She doesn't even have that many years, but she still gets so many good ones in there. My mom has some great lines. My friend Harriet has some great lines. But in that way, it's sort of a commonplace book. Like it's also a way of dramatizing the ways in which wisdom feels like a collaborative and communal process of like knowledge making. But one of the lines that I think is the best line in the book is from a man who I knew in a meeting once, and he had been addicted to heroin for many years, and he shared this very simple thought that I loved. He said he liked when he got hungry. He liked when he got hungry for food, because he said hunger is my body's way of telling me it wants to be alive, and I'm kind of writing really towards and from and around the gravitational energy of that idea here. When I'm thinking about a lot of forms of hunger that sort of rose up with ferocious acuity in the aftermath of my marriage, like hunger for, not just like hunger ultimately for like, you know, love and the kind of rush of a love affair and for different kinds of like freedom and journey, but also just like hunger for the world, like hunger for New York City. I feel like I lived in New York with a kind of different and deeper intensity after my marriage ended, and I wanted to write that sharpened hunger. It was like a hunger that sometimes felt like it was like a hunger for everything all around me, like a hunger for the way the air smelled, a hunger for, you know, the stories of every single person with me on the subway, a hunger for the sweat of strangers like in a tenement bath, you know, it was that kind of voraciousness. And I do think that it does feel connected to me to the way that sobriety felt, especially early sobriety felt, like suddenly I was awake. I was like, I was conscious of everything because I wasn't numbing myself to things anymore. And so, you know, sometimes I've described early sobriety is like an uncomfortable level of awareness, like waking up during a surgery that you're supposed to stay unconscious during, that it's like, I'm not supposed to be awake in this way. I'm not supposed to be feeling every single thing at like full capacity and intensity. But I think that awareness is also that kind of relentless awareness is also very much what my creative impulse is sort of fueled and sustained by, is this real feeling and faith that the world is full of things that will repay one's noticing energy.
Did you write all of your books sober?
Not all of them. But most of them. Not my novel, but the ones after.
I need to read the novel. I'm a completist. A moment ago, I loved what you were saying about the feeling that one is performing oneself, but not with one's best friends. And one of my favorite lines in the book it's one of yours, actually. You say, and this is also toward the beginning, my mother is the only person I've never felt that I had to impress. And that, oh, brutal. I think if I'm really being honest, I would have a similar, not about my mother, but, you know, we all like to think that we're simply, you know, reacting genuinely, but, you know, I mean, I don't usually wear this, and I'm wondering, can you say a little bit more about these, I guess we can, yeah, I mean, it's coming off of what we were just talking about regarding, like, this deeply internal, almost bodily feeling of hunger impelling you to be alive and to be a writer. Sort of, how is that counterbalanced with the need to be alive in public and, you know, be a writer, but, you know, sort of, like, you know, be a writer? And I guess what I'm hoping that you will say in response is like, it should be like 40% internal. I'm wondering what thoughts you have about that.
Two things to say about that, and one is about my mother, and the other is about being in public. I feel that my mother is an almost archetypal hero in this book. But she also is in life. Some people in this room know her. She's a truly extraordinary person, and I also feel that she's so definitional to my conception of what love is, that it actually took some work, like the work of finding language for this lifelong nourishment of friendship. It took some work to find a way of speaking about my mother that was not just sort of saying in some dumb, insistent way, just love, 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 good, need, love, good, need, you know, these, that's the kind of language that comes most readily when I, you know, try to express what my mother means to me. So to come to that language of my mother is the person in the world who I think I've never felt I needed to impress, was actually part of this, the work and gift of the book was trying to understand better what it was that had always felt so safe about her love, and what it was that part of the urgency of wanting to translate the love I had received into a kind of sharpened cognitive understanding of that love was that I was so desperate to give my daughter what I felt I had been given. And sometimes I do think about the love story in this book as a kind of, I'm like a lightning rod that's just conducting the energy that I was lucky enough to receive and trying to kind of pass it on. But in that deep, urgent desire to give to my daughter what I had been given, I had to sort of figure out better what that something was that I had been given. And so there are moments of, especially in the third section, Fever, which is partially about early pandemic quarantine and my particular experience of kind of being in this little unit with my daughter when I was sick, and we were just there in the apartment, just the two of us, she was two, and you know, these hours and hours of playing and getting kind of feeling insane, you know, feeling driven and bored out of my mind, but really starting to think about that boredom as a gift that I was giving her, because it was to think, oh, my mother is the person where I've never worried about being boring, right? And maybe my daughter could someday feel that way about me, you know? So, but then I think the public self is the self where I do think, and sometimes, you know, I feel so grateful to my father, who's been this wonderful figure in my life in many ways, but was somebody where I did feel sometimes I need to be a little bit more interesting. But I think that the self I am in public, you know, probably exists in part because I don't think it's the worst thing in the world to feel some of that pressure, right? How does one make oneself? How does one make oneself interesting? How does one make oneself the kind of person who can write a book or five books, or, you know, and that And that engine, the intensity of needing to make things and needing to make a self and needing to deliver that self to the world, I know that some of that animating energy is in a way left over from some of the dinner tables.
That's great. I think it's time to go to the audience. If anybody has a question, there are some mics that are going to make their way around.
Hello. Hi, Sarah. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Wednesday.
Hi. Leslie, I'm so delighted to know that your book is about divorce and to read it and to hear you talk about it. And I wanted to just kind of tap your inner cultural critic. I know that this is very literary work and that you decided to write a memoir. And I want to tap Sarah's too. So I'm a social scientist. I'm an anthropologist and I study sex and relationships and gender. And in my field, you know, what we've been really noting, a huge cultural shift away from marriage, right? So poorer people are saying, they're delaying marriage, they're saying, we can't afford to get married. Richer people are eschewing marriage because there's not as much stigma for them about childbearing outside of marriage. People who are married are more interested now in living apart together relationships, right, or non-monogamous arrangements. And I've been studying a cohort of women in their 50s, and the first trace that interested me in their social behavior was that they were dating younger men. And another anthropologist and I were trying to figure out why are these women in their 50s, who are most of whom initiated their divorces, women in their 50s initiate divorce more than any other group, so you're an outlier because you're young. But we said, why are they doing this? Why do the ones who are straight want to be with younger men? And the reason was they were finished with marriage. They had other reasons, of course, as you can imagine. But the main one was these young guys don't want to get married. So I just wanted to pose the question sort of playfully, because I love both of your brains so much on feminist topics and topics about intimacy and just our social behaviors. To just playfully ask the question, why marriage? Who cares? Why remarry? Why marry? I just want access to your brains on that question. And thank you for a wonderful talk.
I sense you might get slightly different answers from us on this question, although I will only speak for myself. I mean, yeah, I mean, I feel I'm not an anthropologist. So I certainly don't want to speak for everyone who chooses to get divorced in their 50s or their 40s or their 30s. But I guess there's a moment in the book at the end of the first section, Milk, which is like kind of the moment when I'm really coming to an awareness that my marriage is done. But the way that moment of realization is narrated is a moment when I'm co-officiating my best friend's wedding. So my best friend got married in the Canadian Rockies to a wonderful man, and I basically delivered the eulogy there. So I delivered a speech. What?
Not eulogy.
Sorry. Oh, not eulogy. Well, it was. Oh my God. No, it was a. Yeah, it was. It was a eulogy, but it was pretending to be something else. It was. It's perfect. Yes, I was being 100% more honest than I intended to be there. It was a homily. It was supposed to be a homily, but it was both at once, I guess, is what I'm really trying to say in my answer to this question, is that I was coming to this like deep and kind of like unavoidable awareness that my own marriage was done. But at the same time, I was delivering this very public, this kind of connects to your question about public, this very public speech about what marriage was good for, to your question, Wednesday. And one might imagine a feeling of intense cognitive dissonance. Like, I have just spent years sort of figuring out all the reasons that my own marriage is untenable, and here I am standing in front of a group of people kind of making a case for these two people who are embarking on a lifelong, hopefully lifelong marriage with each other. And there was a kind of, there was a feeling of dissonance in that moment. Like, there was a feeling of dissonance that is the dissonance between a homily and a eulogy. You know, that I was like lamenting what was gone in my own life, even as I was like sending my best friend forth into this future. But I think, and this is really my answer to your question, Wednesday, that what didn't feel like cognitive dissonance to me in that moment had to do with the fact that there was like, it was absolutely consistent for me emotionally that I did believe so much still in what long-term romantic partnership could be. And that was what I felt my friend Colleen had found, and that was what I was kind of sending her forward into and wishing for her, and that the part of me that had come to the realization that my own marriage was not that anymore was the very same part of me that believed in the possibility of those things, that believing in the possibilities of long-term partnership and even believing in some of the things that I had believed in when I had set out on my own marriage, that there was a kind of genuine good in committing to something larger than or more abiding than what one felt or wanted in any given moment, to kind of want something beyond or beneath revocability, that to recognize that my own marriage hadn't been those things wasn't to me a kind of foreclosure of the possibility of those things more broadly. It felt very commensurate in this way with, like, I still believe in those things, and that is in fact why I've come to feel that this bond that isn't those things is untenable. So I guess, you know, what I'm trying to say is that there is a real abiding faith that I have in long-term partnership, and that faith was the part of me that was speaking when I spoke at my friend's marriage, and that faith is the part of me that was still hungry for many things, even by the end of the book, and not just hungry for, you know, the way Prospect Park smells in the spring, and not just hungry for the feeling of my daughter's skin, and not just hungry for, you know, the wind in my hair on a road trip, but like hungry also for like what abiding love could feel like, and what transformation inside a relationship rather than simply through its rupture could feel like. So that faith persists. I also, at a certain point in the book, you know, describe myself as like akin to a child who's been burned by a stove and just keeps touching it over and over again anyway. So perhaps that faith is present in that touching the hot stove again and again. But Sarah, why don't you share a few words?
I want to make sure everybody has a chance to share what they feel moved to share. But I just feel like I'm too old to answer this question. I feel like Benjamin's angel of history, and I feel that what I have seen, I cannot unsee. That's really all I should say.
Thank you. Is this thing on? Yes. Hi. Wow, I'm such a fan of both of your writing, so this is such a treat and been such a pleasure. As so many people have noted and has been discussed tonight, I feel like there's such a vivid sense of documentation in your book of like just attunement to the world around you and in your writing as a whole. And I found myself particularly with this book almost more than any of the others that I've read of yours, like just constantly wondering what your note-taking or journaling process was like, and especially in the context of a book like this, which feels like so condensed, like time-wise, you know, covering just a couple few years, wondering at what point, like how that connects to when you know you're writing a book, like when is it a note and when is it a journal entry and when is it like, oh, I'm making a splinter.
Yeah, once I start to bleed, then I know I've made a splinter. Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and I think, you know, I am often taking notes on experience, not in an every single day I write down all the things that happened that day kind of way, but when I'm inside of experiences that have a certain kind of emotional intensity or where there's some sort of tension or just a very acute feeling, I am often compelled to kind of try to write down some of the particulars of the experience in a pretty immediate way. And often And often I do write down a lot of actual tangible sensory particulars, not just the feelings that they're attached to. And part of that comes from, like, I have been a kind of sporadic but lifelong journal keeper. And once I started to look back on old journals, I realized that I felt really frustrated and bored when they were just abstract, when I was just writing about what I was feeling, but that whenever I would kind of stumble upon an actual concrete particular, a thing I had eaten for breakfast, or like an actual space or an apartment or a building, or like the, you know, it, being in somebody's cold apartment at 3 a.m., like listening to Blood on the Tracks and doing coke, like then I was like, oh, okay, yes. That's what desperation felt like, more than if I wrote the word desperation 15 times on the page. So the sometimes rereading old journals started to change the way that I kept notes about experience, because I realized that like those concrete particulars were actually the things that took me back into the zone or terrain of feeling most powerfully anyway. And then in early motherhood, I was the least equipped to take notes, or I had the least time to take notes, but I also was feeling like everything about the experience of motherhood felt, you know, simultaneously sort of banal and profound, but it did feel very intense in a way that set off that kind of spidey sense inside of me of like, that I want to start writing. I want to write some things down. Like I want to make this experience available to a future version of myself if I can. And I had some sense that the best way to make it available was to jot down little pieces. So I was just taking some notes at first during the period of time that this book is about. And then over time, those notes sort of started to almost gather themselves like little magnetic filings into the shape and form of these splinters that they became. The last thing I'll say about that is, like, I also, when I'm deeper into the book writing process with both this book and my book, The Recovering, I did some kind of intentional work with what I think of as, like, personal archives. So, like, Gmail and text threads and even things like, you know, receipts or cell phone photos, or, you know, all the kind of detritus of living that we're all gathering, even if we don't think of it as archives. And that interest in my own personal archives really came from spending time in other people's archives, so The Recovering, where I'm spending a lot of time in the archives of artists who got sober or tried to get sober. And I started to think, oh, wow, I'm fascinated by these archives because of the weird ways they ambushed me with forms of truth and particularity I couldn't have imagined. And at a certain point I realized, like, yeah, I have those like terrifying forms of truth and particularity available in my own, you know, it's not the Beinecke library at Yale, but like I do have a really big Gmail backlog, you know, so yeah.
Thank you, and thank you all for being here. And Leslie's book is outside, she will be signing, but Sarah has some books out there too, so please feel free to buy both and have them sign them for you. Thank you all for being here. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible by Hearst Foundations, Golden Globes Foundation, LA County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox Schiff, the Steve and Judith Krantz Foundation, Estate of Suzanne E. Aaron, and individual Library Foundation donors and members. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library. To support programs like these, become a member at lfla.org.